Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name, you will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey everybody, welcome in, it's David Summers, and here it comes, another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America, as told by the Tennessee Stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring and back into time. Let's get wall-to-wall and tree-top tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. All right, so where you guys are sitting, Ron, you probably are not going to be in the eventual shadows of the storm that's coming through.
No, I think we're going to be on the edge of it. We might see some rain, but that's about all we're going to get. I feel a little sorry for my brother down there, though, Tampa area.
Yeah.
Well, this is going to be the second one he's had to deal with in the last month. So, and I always get a big kick when he calls me, man. He's always complaining. Hot dog, man.
Here comes another one.
Yeah.
Well, I've got an uncle in that area, too, down in Brandon, Florida. And so he kind of says, well, I think it's basically kind of going to bounce off the edge of that part of the state of Florida, but it looks like this storm is eventually called Helene. Maybe it's called Helene now. Is going to run right up about central Georgia, around Thomasville, Georgia, and keep moving to the north and then curl off to the east or the west one way or another. And so we've been a little concerned in this area. At one point, one of those models showed it coming in here, and nobody wants that. So we wish the best for anybody in the path of that eventual storm that could be rolling up in here Thursday or Friday. Hey, you want to do a show? You ready to do it?
Yes, sir, my man.
All right.
We got a good one for him.
Yeah, I think so. All right, so the last Studcast, number 366, in my opinion, had one of the best cards in Southeastern Gulf Coast history. I thought it was really good.
Well, that's kind of saying a lot, Dave, because they had a lot of good ones down there. But I can say I do agree to a certain extent. But honestly, the card that we have coming in this Studcast, it's going to be just as good or possibly even better than that last card. So we had a great crew during this time frame, and it seemed like every week we had tremendous cards, and it wasn't going to stop at this point. We had it rocking, man. And we not only had the World Junior Heavyweight Champion, Les Thornton, coming back soon, but we also had the NWA World Champion, Harley Race, coming in early October of 1980 for several title defenses.
Wow. To me, it seemed like Les Thornton, the World Junior Heavyweight Champion in 1980, made quite a good impression on the fans on his first time in the Southeastern Gulf Coast territory. What do you think?
Well, yeah. Obviously, he made a good impression on the fans, but more than that, it made a great impression on the wrestlers themselves. They had their first chance, all of us, to get a look at him. And, wow, we were all pretty blown away by it. He was another Tony Charles, right? So in the next month of our Studcast, October of 1980, I'm talking about, we're going to have several double world championship cards. That means we're going to have both Harley Race and Les Thornton defending their belts on the same night. Southeastern also had its doors closed in Tennessee at this point, But boy, we were on fire down there on the Gulf Coast, and the southeastern Gulf Coast territory had now replaced Knoxville as the best little territory in the world.
No doubt about that, Stud. And on the horizon, coming about 2 months after this Studcast, you were going to be adding Birmingham, Alabama to the southeastern Gulf Coast territory, which was then the only southeastern territory. Birmingham was going to be the largest city either southeastern territory had ever had a match in. So since we're on this subject of Birmingham, where are we going to kick this thing off and start riding today?
We're going to touch, man, on a couple of different subjects today. Let's start with Knoxville, discussing that devastating effect that Georgia promoter's sale had and how they handled that with the fans and how that was going to affect that future of that city and that part of the country for years to come. And then we're going to ride into Birmingham and discuss the only city in southeastern history you just mentioned a minute ago. Not only were they the biggest city, but it was the only city that we ever had two television stations each week, both there in the same show. So we'll also talk about the huge billboard sale by there months earlier and what was going on up there all around Birmingham and across that area. And we're going to talk about the next spectacular southeastern Gulf Coast card, which was as good as, and as I said a minute ago, maybe even better than the last one. We'll cover the TV show to promote that card, the results of the matches and attendances, not only in the three major markets, but throughout the territory. Then hopefully we may have time for another learning tree question.
Wow, how could this Studcast card be better than the last one? It sold out every major arena in the territory, so I can't wait to hear what is on this Studcast card, because it's got to be a good one, I know that. It sounds like another big ride to me. I'm saddled up and ready, so how are you going to start this thing? Where do we begin?
Let's start the day with Knoxville, man, and the devastating way the second sale of the territory was handled between the Georgia promoters and the new owners, Black Jack Mulligan and Ric Flair. And it kind of screams to me that the Georgia promoters couldn't wait to get out of town, man. And the new owners were definitely not ready at that point to present their first event. And so let's go back to 1974 and when I bought out John Kazana, kind of how things were transferred during that transition period. And I put together a card every week after the sale. There was never a single night that the fans lost their matches, and no one ever knew anything so far as even the ownership had changed. So the name of Southeastern Wrestling was not even mentioned in the first month that I had that territory. Didn't even call it Southeastern for a month, and that was after John Kazana left. So it was a really smooth transition from Kazana to me. So smooth, in fact, that the fans never knew I had anything to do with Southeastern Wrestling at all. So when the Georgia promoters took over from me after my sale to them, several of my wrestlers and I were on their first three or four cards before we disappeared. Most importantly, obviously, they ran those cards every week. It just continued smoothly to run, kept going. And most importantly, the name of the wrestling company remained Southeastern. So that made it a really smooth transition from me to them. And the fans had no idea they were new owners. The transition of the sale from the Georgia promoters to the new owners, Mulligan and Flair, was horrible. And Kazana's sale to me, then my sale to the Georgia promoters, the fans never missed a single week without their regular live event. And they were still watching the same company, Southeastern Wrestling. So I can only imagine what they were thinking when the fans, after the Georgia promoter sale, had no live event of any kind in that territory for 5 weeks in a row.
Wow, are you serious? So no show or matches at all in Knoxville in the entire month of September or even the first week in October of 1980. That's crazy.
That's exactly what it was, man. And can you imagine what, with all that going on, what was happening at the TV station where their Southeastern Wrestling Company that they had been very happy with for 5 years was going to become another company entirely. So, I almost forgot about 6 weeks before the sale, the Georgia promoters fired Les Thatcher as the TV commentator, who had been on that show for six straight years. He'd basically become the voice of Southeastern wrestling.
Oh, no doubt. You got to be kidding. I mean, all this was going on at the same time. So it's no wonder the great wrestling city of Knoxville that we knew was a great wrestling city, it was dying. That is unbelievable. All right, I'm sorry, Stud. I mean, this was just horrible. So how did any of the fans take this? Can we move on to Birmingham, Alabama, and maybe get some better news and more on this subject maybe next episode?
Oh, yeah, well, I agree, man. It's pretty hard to take, I'll tell you, transitioning from one company to another. But when you look at it closely, we were in exactly the same situation in Birmingham at that time, and maybe even worse. We were switching companies for the Birmingham fans from the Mid-American territory in Nashville, where they'd been getting their wrestling for 30 years, to Southeastern.
All right, so I'd never really thought about it like that. You were dealing with the same thing in Birmingham, being new owners as the Knoxville owners. So this is becoming a major story in and of itself.
Well, let's go ahead, man, and dive into it, man. And let's ride into Birmingham, and which my partners and I, the way it all started is we bought the rights along with all of the rest of Northern Alabama 4 months earlier in May of 1980 from Nick Gulas in Nashville. He was the former partner of my grandfather, Roy Welch. And after the first 3 months, we were still 3 months away from our first Southeastern Birmingham event. So we had an unheard of two TV stations in the same market airing our show. I don't know that ever happened anywhere, anybody else in the country. One of those stations was WBMG. That was Nick and Royce. They'd been on that station for 30 years, and they obviously switched over to the Southeastern TV show the day we bought it. That was part of the deal. I wanted them off. We wanted to get our Southeastern show in there, and we were going to be by the time we were going to reach September of 1980, it was going to be four more months before we were going to have a single live event there yet. So the WBMG TV station signal, though, wasn't the strongest in the area. In fact, it was one of the weakest. And after doing some research, I found out that the strongest TV station in the state of Alabama was Birmingham's WBRC. And I also found out that BRC was looking for a wrestling show. So the last thing we needed, man, was another wrestling company getting on TV in Birmingham. And although it was the last thing I wanted to do, as it turned out, it may have been the best thing that we ever did in Birmingham, this little deal that happened. So going on that station as well gave us coverage in parts of Georgia, Mississippi, and Tennessee, and all of northern Alabama. So from the eastern border over there in Georgia to the western border in Mississippi and all the way north to Tennessee, it brought Southeastern wrestling into every home. It kind of reminded me, man, of the powerful WBIR TV station in Knoxville that had that very strong signal going out as much as 150 miles to the north of Knoxville into Kentucky.
Yeah, wow.
And when I left that weak signal station in 1975 that John Kazana was on for many, many years, and I moved to WBIR, it changed everything for us. Southeastern instantly went from being a one-city market and him only running two towns a week to a territory with six cities running every week. And that powerful WBIR signal, it catapulted us, man, into thousands of new homes up in that part of the country where wrestling had never been seen in some of them. So WBIR did that for us in the three states of Tennessee, Kentucky, and Virginia because it was strong enough that it got into all those states. WBRC, in Birmingham, did the same thing for us, big time, man. Not only did it get us into many of those cities close to Birmingham, but it got us in homes all over northern Alabama.
All right. So having been in that type of business, I do understand the power of a strong signal on a TV or a radio station, especially in my case, and what it can do to bring in customers from far away if you have a strong signal. So, I mean, you had no chance of reaching otherwise without a big signal like that. So what about the other form of advertising you mentioned earlier, like billboards? So I'm really intrigued by them, and I'm certain very few wrestling promoters used them. And I like the way you seem to use them and to really appreciate the effectiveness of billboards.
Yeah, I don't know any other wrestling promoters in the world that used billboards other than I did. And I don't know why, man. Nobody seemed to recognize the power of billboards. And like I said, I may have been the only one that ever used
them. Hey, what gave you that idea in the first place?
Well, you know, just about every person is connected, man, to television and radio in some form. You know, they all have radios and TVs and whatever. And the only other kind of promotional vehicle that I could think of with that kind of numbers had to be, think about it, the numbers of cars and trucks and driving down the highways and streets all across America. And with the people inside those vehicles, they're reading these signs on the sides of the road, making them basically captured customers for those business owners that were smart enough to put their messages on those signs, right?
All right, so I've never heard of such a simple explanation of the effectiveness of highway billboards as that. So one way or the other, you were going to read some of them, even if you tried your best not to look at them.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's really true. And that's really the beauty of billboards. I had not done, you know, my best. I had done my best to capture as many customers with TV exposure, having two television stations in the same market. And now I was about to capture the attention of all those that had to travel the streets and highways in that area. And to be honest, I'm not sure which of these two kinds of advertising were the most effective. And that's why I used billboards so often, I guess. So I always knew when my wrestlers, it was always cool when my wrestlers got their first look at the billboards and when they came out, because the first thing they did is they came right to me and they said, gosh, Ron, I saw a billboard, man.
Yeah.
Wow, what a great idea, right?
Yeah.
They were like always blown away, you know. And I figured, so, you know, if they came to me, you know, what are the fans' reaction going to be? They're going to be the same as these guys.
Right.
So a little later, we're going to be talking about the card for the second week in September of 1980. But on this same weekend, 250 miles north of Southeastern's home base, Pensacola, Florida, mm-hmm. hundreds of those billboards were going up within 50 miles of Birmingham. And we were going to have wrestling on those billboards for the first time ever in that market. Mm. So do you know what, who was the first one to tell me that they saw one of those, Dave?
I have no idea. So they were going up so far north of my area of the Dothan area or along the Gulf Coast. So I don't know who was the first to see one.
Well, it was my cousin, Jimmy Golden. And he had gotten badly hurt and left the sport many months earlier. He was living in Hoover, Alabama, which was just outside Birmingham, mm-hmm. running a gas station for his father. And he called me up, and he was so excited. He said, Ron, I saw a billboard, man. I said, wow, you know, what's this all about? And then he said, you're coming to Birmingham, right? You're finally going to come to Birmingham.
Yeah.
And he thought the billboards were obviously a great way to promote our going there.
Wow. I had forgotten, you know, sadly, we maybe had all forgotten about Jimmy, who was on the sidelines after getting hurt. So I bet it made you feel good, real good, and confident that you had made a good buy.
Well, I certainly did, man. But something else told me, man, during this conversation about the billboards that made me feel even better than that. And he got hurt so bad, man, when it happened, I was afraid he was never going to wrestle again. And he told me he had met a physical therapist that showed him some exercises for his back. Yeah, that's where his injury was. And you can't wrestle with a bad back. I mean, there's no way that you can survive it. So, and he said that he was doing these exercises every day, and he was getting stronger every day. So I had an idea here that Jimmy was maybe looking at coming back, and he nor I knew it at this point that 5 months later, January of 1981, Jimmy Golden was going to return to Southeastern and to wrestle. And his ring career after he returned, Dave, lasted 40 more years.
Wow. And nobody could forget that. That is something, some things we might have forgotten, but you don't forget that. Truly amazing for Jimmy. We've talked about some great things already today, Stud, but the story about Jimmy to me was the best news yet, because we haven't heard you talk about your cousin in quite a while. All of this so far has been extremely interesting. So before we take our break, why don't you set us up with the card that you said earlier was possibly as good as the card in the last Studcast that sold out everywhere, everywhere it ran, and was with raised prices. You had to bump it up a little bit.
Yeah. So this, I got to say, this was an exceptionally good card for this Studcast. The opening match was a historic start to the card. Right off the bat, it had a newcomer in his very first match ever, who is going to become the NWA Rookie of the Year in 1981, Brad Armstrong, at his first match wrestling against Sweet Brown Sugar. Then the Big C, who had grown unhappy with his tag team champion, having lost their belts, he decided he wanted to bring in his own masked partner and win the belts himself, him and his partner. And it was going to be the introduction of the Big C, 1 and 2. They're going to be wrestling against Ricky Gibson and Charlie Cook. Then for the United States Junior title on the line, champion Tony Charles, who was still angry over the refereeing job Jerry Stubbs did on the World Junior match in the last Studcast, was going to be defending against Jerry Stubbs. Joe LeDuc was coming back again against his opponent the last week, who was in a Canadian lumberjack match with him, Ron Bass. And this time, they were going to be in a Texas death match, an even more violent match. And in a Southeastern Championship match, no disqualification rules, the champion Mongolian Stomper, managed by the Big C, was going to be against me. Then in the nine-man elimination match the week before, Rob and Plowboy Frazier ended up the last two men in the ring, with Plowboy's buddy Floyd at ringside. Rob was about to get the Fuller leg lock on Plowboy when Floyd jumped on the apron of the ring and drew the referee over to where he was. Plowboy got something out of his tights. He knocked Rob out with it while the referee tried to get Floyd off the apron. Never saw him hit Rob with it. Then the referee, obviously, was forced to count Rob out. What's he going to do? Then the $5,000 check was handed to Plowboy, but he never got to spend it. This money was held up by the Southeastern Commissioner, Don Curtis, and Rob and Plowboy were going to be on this card again. not only for the money, but if Plowboy lost, even though he didn't have any much hair on his head, his head was going to be shaved. And so was Floyd, who had a head full of black hair, man. So, and if Rob lost, he was going to have to leave Southeastern. So Bob Armstrong, who wrestled Randy Rose in that first match on that last card, and Rose was managed by the Big C. Bob had managed to not only beat Rose, but he ended up taking Big C's black glove off, and he took it to the dressing room with him. He left the ring with Big C's glove. So the last match on this card was going to be a result of that match, and it had real repercussions. The loser of this match was going to have to leave Southeastern.
Wow, you were not exaggerating at all when you said this card might be better than the last one. All right, as bookers, you and Robert cleverly used almost every match from the last card to make this card even better. You built on it. So it had Brad Armstrong's debut, two championship matches, a Texas death match, and two possible loser leaves Southeastern matches. That is a great card. All right, we're going to be hearing all about it when we come back after the break as this Studcast continues in a moment. Hey, everybody, David Summers once again, and Ron has asked me to make the thousands of Studcast fans aware that he has tremendous plans in the near future for his new Studcast. It will improve the original Studcast with many great dramatic surprises to enhance what has become one of the best wrestling podcasts in the world. The new Studcast will be incorporated with a new streaming channel and offer everything that is the Tennessee Stud. The streaming channel will become the hub for all that he does, audio and video, for fans around the world. You'll be hearing more about this in the near future. All right, welcome back into the Studcast. This is episode number 367. It's called Plowboy's Defeat Delivers Record Crowds. So I got a feeling we're about to hear about that. I can't wait to hear about how you were going to cover all of these great matches that you just set up on this week's card on this TV show. So, hey, have at it, Stud. I want to hear this.
All right, well, here we go, Dave. I'll tell you what, you can tell me at the end of the show, man, how I did on this.
You got it.
So the show opened, man, with a video in progress. Matches was actually taking place when it came on the air. And it was a tremendous, it was the last 3 minutes of this great match between Les Thornton and Tony Charles for the World Junior Heavyweight Championship. And, wow, what a great way to open the show. And this match ended up in a one-hour time limit draw with everybody in the three buildings that this match was in. All three buildings totally sold out, everybody standing on their feet. Tony Charles with his United States Junior Heavyweight Championship then came to the set with Charlie as soon as that was over. And, wow, he got himself a standing ovation from the crowd, just like the ones in the video that they had just seen. And Charlie, was aware of what was coming next in the show's format. So he welcomed Tony, and he threw it right then to the ring announcer for the first television match. Jerry Stubbs was a former U.S. junior champion. He entered the ring, and as you can imagine, to a chorus of boos. His heat had gone through the roof after the way he had refereed that World Junior title matches. And so it didn't take him long to beat his opponent. In fact, he barely gave Charlie and Tony Charles enough time to set up the rest of the video that they were going to open the show with. So Stubbs left the ring, and instead of going to the dressing room, he went straight to the set. First thing he did was warn Charlie Platt not to show the last part of the video that they just showed at the beginning of the show when they opened the TV. Mm. So, you know how Charlie was, man. Well, he didn't hesitate to ignore his request, and he asked the director to play the rest of that video, the last part. Mm-hmm. So, and it was the very end of the World Junior Heavyweight Championship match. Then Stubbs instantly got so upset, man, he made a move. He was going to snatch Charlie across the desk, and Tony Charles got between them. And thankfully, he kept Charlie from maybe having to brush himself off. And, it showed Jerry Stubbs, when the video started, quickly trying to leave the ring at the end of the World Junior Championship match because it had ended up in a draw, and he had messed with Tony Charles and Les Thorne the entire one-hour match, did all these horrible things. He made their night miserable before this happened, and the match ended. So he was going to get out of the ring and get gone as quick as he could. And then the studio crowd exploded, man, because it showed Tony Charles and Les Thorne both grabbing Stubbs. And they started giving him these towering throws, man, from one side of the ring to the other, taking turns. until they left him laying flat on his face. He had to be carried back to the dressing room by two other referees came and got him.
Wow.
Couldn't walk out of there. So during all this video, Stubb kept demanding Charlie stop the video. Because he didn't want him to see what happened to him at the end of that match. So he kept trying to get past Tony to get to Charlie. So he finally gave up and he headed back to the dressing room. The studio, everybody in the studio crowd were just roaring at laughter. They were all making fun of him at that point.
Oh, man, I wish I'd been around to see that. That's a great way to open a TV show. Okay, so what comes next, Doug?
Well, the Mongolian Stomper and the Big C, man, it came to the set. Big C had his right arm wrapped in a white gauze from his elbow down to his hand. They joined Charlie at the set. Big C was obviously extremely angry because Bob Armstrong had taken what he described as his protective glove off his hand and kept it. And he said, you know, now he's left me totally defenseless, right? As only Big C could do. So then he said he was going to get it back, though. He said, I've got plans. I'm going to get it back. And then he ranted about being disappointed with his former tag team champions, that they had recently lost the belts, and he was going to bring in a new mask partner, calling him Big C number two. And he says, I'm bringing him in for me because we are going to become the new Southeastern Tag Champions. I'm going to take care of the job myself, basically.
Okay.
So then Charlie, you know, finally found a spot to stop him, which wasn't easy. And then he asked for the director to run the video and it was going to show the rest of the reason for his inviting Big C out here to the set to begin with. So it showed me after coming down to the ring to check on my brother, taking away the $5,000 check that was being presented to Plowboy Frazier and tearing it up. So, but then the Stomper didn't want this, and the Big C didn't want this being shown. So Stomper and Big C, they came down as I had my back turned and I had ripped up the check from Plowboy. They came down and they both attacked me from behind. I didn't see them coming. I was paying attention to Plowboy and to the announcer who was handing him the money. And so they kind of they took advantage of me, man. And I was going to be there in the next match. Mm-hmm. So I was wrestling against Stomper for the Southeastern belt. And so they beat me up a little bit before the match ever started. And then as soon as they had me laying on the concrete on the floor outside, they said, ring the bell. Let's start the match, right?
Wow. Well,
that wasn't too cool. I wasn't feeling like I was ready to wrestle at that particular point. So Charlie tried dealing with the Big C, called for the ring announcer. He got tired of it because Big C just kept running his mouth. And he called for the announcer to ring the bell for the next TV match.
Okay, so transition to that next match for us. Who was in that one?
Well, it was me. And after hearing what they had to say, I was in the dressing room. I went to the ring pretty upset. And I took no mercy on the guy that was standing across the ring from me. And I gave him a couple of suplexes and a drop kick, and I beat him with a Fuller leg lock. And I got a pretty good pop from the studio crowd. Wasn't a long match, for darn sure.
Yeah, I bet you did. All right, so this TV show is really moving right along. All right, so how about the personality profile? Set that up for us, Stud.
Well, Bob Armstrong had what, and he was the guy in this particular profile, and what a welcome he got, as always. And fans went crazy, and he joined Charlie at the set. And he was carrying the Big C's black glove with him. And like I said, he got a tumultuous welcome from the studio crowd. And so then he had a video. And they watched the video of how Bob and his match against Randy Rose took the glove away from Big C, showed how he got the glove. And so then he offered right away to give Randy Rose another shot at him, another match with him. and because he beat Rose. And then he says he wanted to give Big C, even give Big C a chance to get his black glove back. So Big C came busting out of the dressing room on the far side of the studio, and Randy Rose was kind of trying to hold him back. And Big C got about 20 feet away from the profile set, and he stopped, and Rose had a hold of his arm, and he screamed that he would agree to anything Armstrong wanted, anything, to get his protective glove back. So Bob sat there, and he said, well, that's great. He goes, I'm really glad to hear that. And then he said, you'll do anything, huh? So he said he would be willing. He said, I'll be willing to give the black glove back. Here's the way I want to do it. He said, I want to take that black glove. I want him to bring in a 20-foot tall pole, and I want to put the black glove on top of the pole. And I'm going to wrestle Randy Rose again, and the first guy that brings that glove down from the top of the pole is going to be able to keep it. And the studio crowd loved that. They exploded. And Big C, he was desperate to get his glove back, and he screamed, yes, yes. He goes, I'm willing to do that right now. And Randy Rose was kind of nodding his head, you know, like, yeah, I'll do that too. So and then Bob said, oh, yeah. And he goes, but I forgot one part of this. He said, I have one more stipulation to this match. He said, I also want the loser of the match, the guy that doesn't get the glove, to leave Southeastern Wrestling. So, crowd popped again, man, even louder than the first time.
Yeah.
So Big C, he was so adamant about getting the glove back, he agreed right away. Yes, yes. He started screaming, yes, we'll do it. We'll do it. You know, but Randy Rose, he was thinking a little differently. His head kind of dropped and he was shaking it a little bit. And then he just turned and walked back toward the dressing room. And so Big C had to go chase him down. You know, hey, come here. You could hear the conversation. He goes, you got to do this because you got to do it for me. You owe it to me, you know. And then he said, you got to do it right now. He may change his mind. And also there was a dead silence in the studio at that point. I mean, Rose was standing there and he kept shaking his head no, but. Finally, he said, okay, I'll do it. And then he quickly just went on into the dressing room. The Big C came running back toward the profile set. And he was yelling, yes, yes, we'll do it. So Bob got up smiling, man. He took the black glove with him, and he went back to the dressing room.
That was a totally different personality profile than usual, obviously, Stud. So short and sweet with a black glove on top of a 20-foot-high pole. And the man that didn't get it had to leave Southeastern. So, really, another great profile, absolutely. This was turning into a great TV show. So, what happened next?
Joe LeDuc went to the set, man, to watch the video of his Canadian Lumberjack match from the previous week against Ron Bass. And it was a bloody match. Always was between these two guys. Both men got... They not only got bloody, but they got whipped like dogs, man, because all these wrestlers had the belts with them out there. And basically, they got disqualified, and this match settled nothing, basically. So it was a brutal match. It ended with everybody, meaning all the wrestlers, even whipping each other with belts. I mean, it ended up just a wild match, but they weren't satisfied. So it seemed like the best way to settle this, Rob and I talked about it, between two animals at this point is what these guys were. And the best way was the Texas death match, in which there was no disqualification. There was no time limit. Falls weren't going to count anywhere in the building. And the match wasn't going to be over until one man, after a 30-second rest period and a 10 count, couldn't get to his feet. So basically, Texas death matches, in my opinion, was the most dangerous match in wrestling.
Wow, I have to agree with you on that. So who was in the ring for the next TV match?
Well, Ron Bass, and like everybody in the ring during this TV show, he took his pain, man. He got rid of some of his pain by giving it away, I guess I'd say, to his opponent. I mean, he passed his pain off to his opponent, and wow, Ron Bass was a monster. And so these two wrestlers, Joe LaDuke and Ron Bass, they were warriors, man. And every match they were ever in that I ever saw them with, they gave everything they had. And on this upcoming card, they were going to be in the fourth match out of seven matches. That's
wow. I mean, to me, that alone says it all about the strength of this card. Those guys in the fourth match out of seven, I think you said. All right, so how did this TV show end?
Well, ended with Plowboy Frazier and Floyd. They were in the ring for the last TV match, and Plowboy squashed his opponent, and I guess that's the only way to put it, 6'10" and 430 pounds. And so, I mean, the guy disappeared under his body. You couldn't see him there, and he left him. He left the ring. He was laughing. He was enjoying himself, and fans hated Plowboy. And it was hard for, I guess, I don't know how Plowboy had any friends, period, the way he looked. And my brother Rob, was the last one to go to the set for this show with Charlie. And he had won the five-man elimination match on the TV the week before. And then he got $1,000 for it. And then he made it to the last two men in this nine-man elimination match in the arenas the following week. And so this video showed a little bit of that. So it ended up with him and Plowboy Frazier, the last two in it. Rob and Charlie watched the video, in that one, the $5,000 again was going to go to the prize for the winner of that. Rob had Plowboy worn out. I mean, you know, that match lasted 90 minutes because it was an elimination match, and those matches were really, really long and a very difficult match to win. And Rob was ready to finish Plowboy off. Plowboy was totally blown up. He'd probably been in the ring 10 times. And then when Plowboy's buddy Floyd jumped up on the apron of the ring, he drew the referee away, and Plowboy popped Rob with something from his overalls and knocked him cold. So that's what I described earlier in this show, where I went to the ring after he, Plowboy, knocked him out. He got the $5,000 check, but I had gone to the ring, and as soon as they handed it to Plowboy, I snatched away from Plowboy and tore it up. So that wasn't the first time Plowboy and Floyd had gotten away with a stolen victory, but no prize money. Rob was willing, I guess, at this point to do pretty much most anything to beat, I guess I'd call him this huge slob. That's all you can say about Plowboy. Don Curtis had sent in a video at the very end of this match where he laid out the stipulations for this single match that was upcoming between Rob and Plowboy. And he told everyone that the winner was going to receive that $5,000 prize that he held up from the week before in the elimination match. And that if Robert won the match, both Plowboy and Floyd were going to have their heads shaved in the ring. And if Plowboy won the match, Rob was going to have to leave Southeastern. Basically, for Rob, it was win and stay, or lose and go, against a guy who was 6'10" tall and weighed 430 pounds. So we're all going to see what happened the following week.
Yeah, I bet so. You asked me earlier to let you and Rob know how you did on putting this TV show together. So I would have to say it was a shocking ending to what I would call a fantastic TV show. So what happened in the arenas the next week? Let's move to that.
Well, Brad Armstrong did something extremely rare, man. He won his first ever match. And he was wrestling a pretty good hand, man, a pretty darn good wrestler, Sweet Brown Sugar. Quite a feat for your first match. Bixie had his new masked partner, the excellent Jerry Brown, one of the original Hollywood Blondes, one of the greatest tag teams in the country. And they were in their first ever tag team match together, and they were wrestling against Ricky Gibson and Charlie Cook. And so in the United States, a junior heavyweight title match, Jerry Stubbs stopped Tony Charles. He regained the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship. And I got to say, back in that other match, Big C's 1 and 2, they beat Ricky Gibson and Charlie Cook. And then in the Texas Death Match, Bass versus LeDuc, Ron Bass, with the help of Big C, won his match over Joe LeDuc. And in the Southeastern Championship match, both the Stomper and I got disqualified. Rob won the match with Plowboy Frazier. He got the $5,000 prize from that 9-man elimination match a week earlier. And fans celebrated wild. The fans loved watching them shave Plowboy and Floyd's head in the middle of the ring. And then last match of the night, Bob Armstrong brought down the black glove. And they placed it on top of the pole. They mounted the pole to one of the ring posts. And then Bob, you should have seen. It was amazing. I never seen somebody climb a pole as fast as he climbed that pole.
Wow.
And Bob was a strong dude, man. I mean, he went up that pole so fast. That match probably didn't last 5 minutes. He came down. He'd won the match, so obviously he'd done what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
But Rose jumped him, and so he put Rose to sleep. And then Big C, along came his new partner, Jerry Brown, who was wearing a mask. It was identical to Big C, the Big C's match. And both of those two caught Bob with him behind Rose, putting Rose to sleep. Mm-hmm. And they took Big C's black glove back. They got his glove. Bob had the gloves, and they took it away from Bob, and they left Bob laying there and went back to the dressing room. Randy Rose had to leave Southeastern.
Wow, that's a great night of wrestling. That was a big night of wrestling, wherever it was. So I think you said earlier you were going to be giving the attendances for all 6 cities this time. So set that up. That's going to be heavy duty right there.
Yeah, we don't normally do that, Dave, but we're crowds were so good at this time frame. I thought we'd just add the other 3 cities that were going that particular week. So every one of the major arenas, all 3 of the major arenas sold out again, just like they had the week before. So they basically had the same number of fans. And last week, for people that remember, there was almost 17,000 fans, 16,800 fans in those 3 cities alone. Then Pensacola, which ran on a Sunday night, it sold out with 5,100 fans. Panama City, which was on a Thursday night, sold out the regular building they wrestled in there. It only held 4,000. It sold out 4,000. We had a match in Troy, Alabama on a Saturday night that drew 4,200 fans.
Wow.
So we had a total of 30,100 fans in 6 nights, which was an all-time record at that point for any Southeastern territory. And then when you think about it, that was done without Mobile being in the main arena. We would have had a lot more if we could have been in the main arena that week.
All right, so just by chance, did you cover yourself in honey, pour the money out on the bed, and roll in it?
Oh, okay. Man, I tell you, I had a lot of happy partners. I can say that.
I bet you did. Wow, that is huge. And 6 nights, that's amazing. All right, so amazing numbers for a territory only 200 miles wide from east to west, 150 miles long. North to south. So no wonder it was the best small territory in the world and everybody wanted to work there. So it looks like we're going to have enough time for a learning tree question. Let's get to that. Mark Cole asked, did the Florida Wrestling Office highlight you're having played basketball for the Miami Hurricanes when you wrestled in Miami in your early years?
Wow, that's a great question, Mark. Son of a gun, man. Well, I got to start, man, by saying basketball at the University of Miami back in the late 1960s when I was there was not that popular a sport, and it's certainly not popular enough for them to be publicizing it in the Miami paper when I was wrestling on the card. It wouldn't have made much sense for, I don't think, the Florida promotion to spend money in that direction. There was one sports reporter, though, a big wrestling fan at the Miami Herald during my basketball years there. He knew my dad was a wrestler, and he wrote several articles about me during my time wrestling, playing basketball, and about my dad being a wrestler. And some of those were after I left the university and basketball. And he kind of followed me in my wrestling career with stories. Every month or so, for the first 6 months that I wrestled, he would call me and ask me about how I was doing and who that I had wrestled. And he was writing these stories and putting them into the Miami Herald paper. So I was getting some publicity, even though I was wrestling in Georgia. I wasn't even in the state of Florida at that point. So he was a very different type of writer. He was pretty cool about the way he handled things. I remember one of the titles of one of the articles was a wrestling dove from Locust Grove. And I lived in a little town called Locust Grove outside of Atlanta, about 30 miles outside of Atlanta. And and the article was probably about who I wrestled that particular time that he was writing the story. So the first wrestling office, I have to say, did little to highlight my basketball background. But there was one person in particular in that office that pushed me big time. And that was the great Gordon Solie. And when I left Georgia and I started wrestling in Florida, 22 years old, he was the TV commentator for Championship Wrestling for Florida, had been for many, many years. And when I first arrived there, like I said, 22 years old, he never failed to mention my basketball background every time I wrestled on television. And Gordon Solie was a very astute person, man. He was so good at what he did. He recognized the small things that so many TV commentators and people in his profession never saw. He was brilliant. And other than some matches in 1973 and 74, quite a few, as a matter of fact, not just some, but as many as almost 40 matches in St. Louis in my first 4 years in the sport, I spent the rest of the time in Florida, wrestling hundreds of times on television there. Gordon never failed to mention that I was a basketball player at the University of Miami. So in 1978, when I opened up my second Southeastern Wrestling Company on the Gulf Coast, I brought Gordon in as a second commentator to work with the talented Charlie Platt. So for a while there in 1978, you had Charlie Platt and Gordon Solie doing Southeastern Wrestling from Dothan, Alabama.
Yeah, yeah.
You couldn't get much better than that, man.
That was big time, yeah.
That was big time. And
yeah.
Gordon was still pushing my basketball background on every one of those shows. And it wasn't long after that that Gordon ended up in Atlanta on the best TV station in the world at that time. Ted Turner's satellite station, WTBS,
yeah,
seen around the world. So years later, when I set up Continental Championship Wrestling, 1985, he was my choice, man, to become the commentator for that show. And luckily, I got to spend basically 5 years with Gordon toward the end of his life, building one of the best wrestling TV shows in history. And sorry, Mr. Cole. Well, you know, I know I've strayed a little bit from the subject you ask about, but I certainly do appreciate the opportunity that this has kind of presented me to also give a little pat on the back to a great man.
Oh, no doubt about it. Okay, so if Charlie Platt and Gordon Sully were singers, Charlie's a good singer, but Gordon was the velvet voice. So, I mean, when he came to Dothan, and we actually went to one of the matches at the TV station and had the opportunity to meet the legendary Gordon Sully. I'll never forget that day because I was like, this dude is big time. And here he is in the Dothan TV studio. So that's awesome. And listen, you always handle these learning tree questions so beautifully. It is always one of my favorite things that we do. So all I can say is, it's been another great one. So where are we going to be riding on the next Studcast?
Well, after the early part of this Studcast today, when the Knoxville fans were getting such a raw deal in a way that that they were being treated and ignored, with the sales moving from one company to another, in the chaos, that entire part of the country, I want to return there next week, and I want to talk a little bit more about how I felt about those fans. They were so embedded in my fiber as a young businessman and an owner of a territory. They were the first fans I had ever experienced as a wrestling promoter. And so, and also we're going to talk about the Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory at this point, 1980. We're doing better than practically any territory in the world. I mean, we were just really kicking butt. And I'd been running up to that point in my career, and all of a sudden everything was good, just falling into place. And so the card there we're going to talk about, as we did today, is going to be another example of a great one. Because we had such a great crew, and we're going to have another great card next Studcast. We'll have a great TV show we're going to talk about to promote that card, the results of the card, the attendances in the major markets, and hopefully we'll have another learning tree too, man.
That's going to be awesome next time we come back on another Studcast. Hey, folks, you know the deal. On Facebook, you can find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. Twitter or X, it's simple, too. He's at Ron Fuller Welch on Twitter or X. You can follow him there as well. Check out the fantastic website, tnstud.com, tnstud.com. This Studcast is going to be there with every Studcast ever done. The Stud Store is where you can get 43 Super Stud Cast, 4 different 8x10 photos, the best-selling novel Brutus, personally autographed to you. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind. When you go to YouTube, put in Southeastern Rewind, it's the first thing that comes up. You'll find hundreds of hours of classic old-school wrestling entertainment, 442 total videos, your last 145 Studcast, Ask the Stud shows, and Short Rides with the Stud. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic stud stories with worldwide stars. Studcast archive stories, Tell Me More fan question shows, Superstars of the Past shows, and so much more. It's YouTube Southeastern Rewind. It's the best deal in wrestling, no doubt about it. All right, any final comments today, Ron?
Yes, I hope you join us, everybody out there listening today for the next Studcast. We drop them every week on Wednesday. Thanks, everybody, for listening today. And we, as always, appreciate your support. Please take care of yourselves and others. May God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me on Facebook at facebook.com/dsummers955. That's Summers with an O. And on Twitter or X, Dave_Doohan. On Instagram, it's instagram.com/DavidSummersProductions. And hit me up anytime at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains.